The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the October 31st, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is an ocean scene. In a small wooden motorboat, we see Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. He's flying a Venezuelan flag. He's shouting angrily with his fist in his air. And he's going right in toward a whole group of U.S. battleships. Looks like there's about five of them coming right at him, and a few fighter jets in the air. The headline is Gunboat Diplomacy, Trump's Plan to Topple Venezuelan Strongman Nicolas Maduro. That is our first main story. We will start there. Trump eyes regime change in Venezuela. What happened? Evidence mounted this week that the Trump administration was seeking regime change in Venezuela as a U.S. counter-narcotics campaign that began with military strikes on alleged drug trafficking boats shifted toward the ouster of President Nicolas Maduro. Some 10,000 U.S. troops have been deployed to the Caribbean as part of a buildup involving at least 8 Navy warships, 10 F-35 fighter jets, missile-loaded drones, a nuclear-powered attack submarine, and a floating base for special operations forces. While the administration's official stance is that the buildup is part of a war against narco-terrorism, unnamed officials have told multiple news outlets that the real goal is the removal of leftist strongman Maduro. President Trump said he had cleared the CIA to pursue covert activities inside Venezuela and said the U.S. is looking at ground strikes. In response, a defiant Maduro mobilized troops along the coast as state media rallied citizens to repel a gringo incursion. The people are ready for combat, Maduro said. The administration expanded its ship bombing campaign, previously limited to the Caribbean, with a strike on a speedboat off Colombia's Pacific coast, killing 2 people. It was at least the 8th vessel to be destroyed since September 2nd, bringing the death toll to at least 34. The president has declared the U.S. to be in armed conflict with drug traffickers, including a cartel he claims is headed by Maduro, and says the attacks are thus legally justified. But he has offered no evidence the targeted boats were carrying drugs, and legal experts say that in any case, the strikes on suspected criminals amount to extrajudicial executions under international law. Colombian President Gustavo Petro accused the U.S. of murder in a September strike he said killed a Colombian fisherman whose boat was damaged and adrift. In response, Trump called Petro a drug leader with a fresh mouth and said the U.S. would cut aid payments to Colombia and impose new tariffs on its exports. As tensions rose, the admiral overseeing the operations in the Caribbean stepped down just a year into his command. Neither Admiral Alvin Halsey nor the Pentagon offered an explanation for his departure, but Tom Shannon, a former senior official at the State Department, said it's likely Halsey thought, this is going to be my legacy, war crimes. What the columnist said, the administration has offered a steadfast rationale for blowing up boats off Venezuela, said Terrence McCoy in the Washington Post. They're operated by narco-terrorists, whose drugs are killing Americans. But numerous experts say those claims don't add up. They note that most of the boats were en route to Trinidad or Tobago, a transit point for cocaine and marijuana headed to Europe and Africa, not America. And the vast majority of U.S. overdoses are caused by fentanyl, which is typically made in Mexico with Chinese ingredients and smuggled north by land, most often by U.S. citizens. The administration hasn't provided the slightest evidence that these boats were carrying drugs, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. And even if they were, there's no legal or even practical justification for blowing them up instead of seizing them. For evidence that the administration is fudging the facts, consider the fate of a Colombian and an Ecuadorian who survived a U.S. boat strike last week. Instead of holding them at Guantanamo or some other military prison, the U.S. returned the supposed terrorist to their home countries, where the Ecuadorian was released for lack of evidence of any wrongdoing. This may have started as a fight against drug trafficking, but the focus has shifted, said Michael Scott in the Financial Times. Insiders and analysts say the administration's priority is now to depose Maduro and his inner circle by convincing them that staying in power will be more costly than leaving. The military buildup delivers the clear threat that if they cling to power, the U.S. may use force to capture or kill them. That shift marks a victory for Secretary of State Marco Rubio, said Jonathan Blitzer in The New Yorker. A longtime regime change advocate, he'd spent months in open conflict with the more conciliatory Trump special envoy, Richard Grenell. The balance of power shifted when top Trump aide Stephen Miller sided with Rubio, seeing the strikes as a means to expand Trump's power and reinforce the idea of Venezuelan immigrants in the U.S. as alien enemies. Trump also had an itch to see more dramatic military action against cartels, and Venezuela presented a safer target than next-door neighbor Mexico. The administration's hope is to spark a military coup against Maduro, said Juan Ferrero and Jose de Cordoba in the Wall Street Journal. But the socialist autocrat has made himself virtually coup-proof. He has jailed or exiled military officers accused of conspiring against him and seated the officer corps in rank and file with domestic spies and counterintelligence officers from his ally Cuba. Maduro foes within the military know that torture, jail, and even death await should they rise up. Trump is courting catastrophe, said Ross Barkin in New York, and Americans should be deeply alarmed. If he topples Maduro, it will create a power vacuum that will be filled with warlords, transnational gangs, and paramilitaries, awash in advanced weaponry. It seems fair to ask what the administration's plan is, said Jim Garrity in National Review, but it shared nothing with Congress or voters. Let's be clear. Maduro is a miserable despot, and his demise would make the world a better place. But our post-9/11 adventures in nation-building have delivered the hard lesson that toppling a dictator is the easy part. What comes after is much tougher. Controversy of the week. Young Republicans. Does the GOP have a Nazi problem? Terms like Nazi and fascist get thrown around too freely these days, said River Page in the Free Press. But when a Republican says, "I love Hitler," in a group chat, what the hell are we supposed to call him? Politico last week reported on an almost eight-month trove of Telegram messages sent between a dozen prominent members of the Young Republican National Federation, the GOP's official youth wing, which was brimming with racism, anti-Semitism, and violent authoritarian musings. Politico counted 251 separate uses of faggot, retarded, and the N-word, along with references to black people as monkeys and watermelon people. There were jokes about sending opponents to the gas chamber and of being ready to watch people burn. Some top Republicans condemned the comments and demanded those involved leave the party. The YRNF state chapters in New York and Kansas were disbanded. But J.D. Vance didn't see a problem. pointing to Jay Jones, the Democratic nominee for Virginia Attorney General, who sent texts wishing death to on a Republican colleague. The vice president dismissed the outrage as pearl-clutching over a few kids telling edgy jokes. Kids? Those involved are in their 20s and 30s, and included Vermont State Senator Senator Samuel Douglas, who has since resigned. And why can't we denounce hate from both Democrats and Republicans? These are Vance's people, said Jeet here in The Nation. A product of the alt-right, he understands that racist and philo-Nazis, once a noisy fringe of conservatism, are now the future of the GOP, a party Vance intends to lead into the 2028 presidential election. Hate is not a deal-breaker for this administration, said Katie Rogers in the New York Times. This week also saw the leak of texts by Paul Ingrassia, President Trump's nominee to head a federal watchdog agency, in which he admitted to having a Nazi streak, and using an Italian slur for black people, called for all Mulligan holidays from Martin Luther King Jr. Day to Juneteenth to be eviscerated. Ingrassia, 30, withdrew his nomination in face of resistance from Senate Republicans, but he remains employed by the White House as a liaison to the Department of Homeland Security. Vance was wrong to dismiss the young Republican's hideous remarks as mere jokes, said Catherine D. in Politico, but we should also not mistake them for genuine expressions of belief. Among the very online right, the ironic embrace of cruelty and bigotry is a way of signaling group membership, as well as one's disdain for the moral surveillance and censoriousness of liberals. Or at least that's how it begins. But through repetition, what begins as mockery can harden into conviction. And someone whose original goal was to own the libs by performing a caricature of right-wing extremism can end up adopting the worldview they once parodied. I fear there's a simpler explanation, said George Packer in The Atlantic. Ambition. These young Republicans wanted to rise in a political party that now prizes contempt for everything decent as a core value. After Elon Musk's Nazi salute, Tucker Carlson's dabbling in Holocaust denial, and Stephen Miller's embrace of white supremacism, these aspiring politicians understandably thought the viler their language, the higher they'll go. That remains a safe bet, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Trump and Vance have a policy of leaving no Nazi-curious chud behind. Ingrassia and the young Republicans may have had their career plans disrupted, but trust me, they'll all be directing ICE raids in no time. It was a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for Fox and friends. After Fox News host Laura Ingraham, who repeatedly criticized the business dealings of President Biden's son Hunter, announced she was joining a business venture with President Trump's son Donald Jr. The firm, Colombier Acquisition Group III, says it plans to fund the next chapter of American exceptionalism. It was a good week for swagger, after researchers concluded that even short men can project physical dominance by the way they walk. Key to a macho strut, they said, are lateral torso oscillation and internal rotation of the shoulder. And it was a good week for Oscar Wilde, after the British literary posthumously reissued a library card to the novelist and playwright 130 years after revoking his original one, following his conviction for gross indecency. The library said its intention was to acknowledge the injustices and immense suffering inflicted on Wilde for the then crime of homosexuality. It was a bad week for sectarianism, after a fan of the Chicago Cubs shouted, "Go Cubs!" as Pope Leo XIV, a Chicago White Sox fan, was waving to crowds at the Vatican. "They lost," replied Leo, whose leadership in the world's 1.4 billion Catholics evidently didn't keep him from following the National League Division Series. It's a bad week for blended families. After a newlywed couple from Bhopal, India, filed for divorce because the husband's pet dog kept barking at the wife's pet cat. "We are making every possible effort to save this marriage," said couples counselor Shail Awasti, "but the wife is not willing to give up her cat." Finally, it was a bad week for reading the room after the San Jose Sharks posted a pro-immigration and customs enforcement message. "SJ Sharks fans love ICE. Get 'em, boys," on its Jumbotron during Hispanic Heritage Night. The hockey team later apologized, saying the message did not meet its values. And the briefing, title this week, "From Tech Billionaire to Media Mogul." Larry Ellison is on a buying spree, snapping up Paramount and CBS and eyeing CNN, HBO, and TikTok. How did Ellison make his fortune? Through Oracle, the database software and cloud computing company he co-founded in 1977. Under Ellison, 81, the firm has grown into a nearly $900 billion tech colossus by devouring its rivals and trying to destroy those it couldn't buy out. During a brutal competition with Microsoft in the 1990s for control of the database and enterprise software markets, Oracle hired private investigators to dig through the trash of pro-Microsoft trade group. "It's not enough that we win. All others must lose," Ellison had said, paraphrasing Genghis Khan. Ellison, who grew up poor on the south side of Chicago, is now the world's second wealthiest person, has used his $350 billion fortune to pursue a string of passion projects. The six times married Oracle chairman has bought up to 98% of the Hawaiian island of Lanai, spent more than $750 million competing in the America's Cup yacht race, which he's won twice, donated more than $350 million to research on aging and age-related diseases, and staged mock dogfights over the Pacific Ocean in military-style jets with his son, David. Business writer and former Wall Street banker William D. Cohen said Ellison is now focused on a different passion project, becoming one of the most powerful media and entertainment moguls America has ever seen. How is he trying to do that? It started with this summer's $8 billion merger between David's production company, Skydance, and Paramount, owner of CBS, Showtime, and movie studio Paramount Pictures. That deal was largely brokered by Ellison. Then, in September, Trump signed an executive order that would transfer ownership of TikTok's U.S. operations and access the social media's app's 170 million American users from Chinese parent company ByteDance to a group of American investors, including Oracle. That deal, valued at about $14 billion, is awaiting approval from Beijing. Paramount Skydance has also bought center-right news startup The Free Press, which has railed against the wokeism of mainstream media, for $150 million. And the Ellisons are now reportedly preparing a bid of up to $80 billion for Warner Brothers Discovery, home of CNN, HBO Max, and the Warner Brothers movie studio. Collectively, those deals could give the Ellisons even more influence than the Murdoch family. Many critics are worried about how the Ellisons will wield that power. Why are they concerned? Because of the closeness between Ellison and Trump. Once a major backer of President Bill Clinton Ellison shifted to the right under President Barack Obama, viewing the Democrat as hostile to Israel. Ellison is Jewish. The tech billionaire hosted a fundraiser for Trump's reelection campaign at his Rancho Mirage, California estate in February 2020. And that year, Trump supported Oracle's attempt to buy TikTok's American operations with Walmart, a deal that ultimately fell through. In November 2020, Ellison joined a phone call where Trump staffers and supporters discussed strategies to challenge the president's defeat at the ballot box. David Ellison later said his father believed Joe Biden won the election. A day after Trump's second inauguration, Ellison appeared at the White House with OpenAI CEO Sam Altman to announce a $500 billion AI data center venture known as Stargate. Trump described Ellison at the event as sort of CEO of everything, and since then the pair have held multiple private meetings. Given Ellison's closeness to the Trump regime, said Media Watch Group Fair, the possibility of him owning CBS, CNN, and a major stake in TikTok would be dangerous for democracy. Has he pushed his media firms toward Trump? Signs of a move to the right can be seen at CBS News. David Ellison, 42, who describes himself as a socially liberal person and who donated nearly $1 million to President Joe Biden's reelection campaign, has hired Free Press founder Barry Weiss as editor-in-chief of CBS News. It's an unusual hire because Weiss is an opinion journalist with no TV news experience. To win approval for the Paramount Skydance merger from FCC chair and staunch Trump ally Brendan Carr, David installed the former head of a conservative think tank as an ombudsman at CBS News to evaluate complaints of bias at the network. Trump said last week that he believes CBS News will become fairer under its new management. Following Carr and Trump's attempt to get late-night host Jimmy Kimmel fired by Disney, some in Hollywood worry that Paramount takeover could lead to movie and TV writers being ordered to avoid subjects that might anger Trump and the MAGA right. What kind of chilling effect could the Trump administration's demand for a conservative viewpoint have on entertainment? An unnamed screenwriter told Vanity Fair, "It's a four-alarm fire, and we ignore it at our peril." Are those fears justified? It's not yet clear. David Ellison has said he does not want to politicize our company in any way, shape, or form, and his main interest appears to be Paramount's entertainment wing, not its news business. And some industry observers note that the Ellisons may be trying to appease Trump, not out of ideological fealty, but because they see a one-off opportunity to build a media colossus that would typically be blocked on antitrust grounds. Who knows how long they will have the administration's ear, said Paul Hardart, a media expert at New York University's Stern School of Business. By combining TikTok's algorithmic approach to entertainment with Paramount's massive audience and media franchises, the family could create an entirely new kind of media business. You have a son who is going into media, a father who is close to Trump and acquiring the most addictive social platform we've ever seen, said Anthony Paloma, a communications and business specialist at the University of Virginia. These are very smart people, and none of this is accidental. And a few of the best columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. Muzzling the Pentagon's watchdogs. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's demand that Pentagon-based journalists halt all independent reporting violates the First Amendment, said retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, and will be poisonous to public trust. Reporters from dozens of media outlets, from the New York Times to Fox News, were expelled from their Pentagon press offices last week after they refused to sign a 21-page obedience pledge to refrain from soliciting any information that the Pentagon hasn't pre-cleared for release. Obsessed with leaks, the insecure Hegseth wants journalists to publish only what he wants the public to know, an unconstitutional form of restraint. As a career military officer, I can assure you that this attempt at censorship will backfire. I didn't love answering reporters' questions, especially when the news was bad. But journalism is how free people hold a military accountable. Giving journalists access to the nerve center of military decision-making helps ordinary people keep eyes on the institution that spends nearly $1 trillion a year, and that sends their loved ones into danger. Hegseth's attempt to muzzle the press will only breed speculation, rumors, and the belief, fair or not, that someone is hiding something. Trump wasn't a victim of lawfare. As President Trump strong-arms his Justice Department into indicting his political enemies, said Jonathan Chait, his defenders are claiming that Democrats brought it on themselves. The prosecutions of Trump that took place while Joe Biden was president, Republicans say, were partisan lawfare that inevitably invited vengeance. This is factually and morally wrong. During his first term, Trump endlessly demanded that the Justice Department go after a long list of targets, including Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. He failed only because his attorneys general and other aides refused such vengeance prosecutions. After he left office, Trump was found liable for both extensive business fraud and sexual assault, and was indicted for the greatest political crime in our nation's history, trying to overturn the 2020 election and inciting the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Trump was also indicted for taking a literal truckload of classified documents back to Mar-a-Lago and for refusing requests to turn the material over. These were not the concocted flimsy charges of his revenge tour, but a Trump-appointed federal judge and a partisan Supreme Court intervened to give him preferential treatment, killing all charges. Trump was not a victim of politicized justice. He was a beneficiary. This column comes from Israel. How the Gaza War Has Changed Us. Israel just survived a generational test, said Avi Kalo and Yedioth Aronoth. Every Israeli government has committed to bringing home POWs, but this return of hostages, both living and fallen, from Hamas captivity is unprecedented. Hamas last week returned the 20 living hostages out of the 251 it kidnapped in the murderous October 7, 2023 raid that launched the Gaza War. Many had been held isolated with little food, some in shackles, in the terrorist group's tunnels under Gaza. We reached this point because President Trump imposed, even if temporarily, a negotiated reality that the hawks had long avoided as they insisted on eradicating Hamas before any ceasefire. The hostages' return has halted the rise of a messianic ultranationalist further that threatened the very foundations of the nation and has given us a chance to heal and unite. But will we take that chance? Asked Eyal Eshel in Ma'ariv. Anyone looking at Israel today sees a tired people, a divided society, and a country on the brink of an abyss. Trust between citizens and government has collapsed, even trust between citizens and the army. My daughter Roni, a soldier, was burned to death when Hamas attacked an IDF base on October 7th, and I could never have imagined it would take 2 years after that black day for the war to end. By continuing the bombing until Gaza was nearly flattened, we have lost the goodwill of many of our former friends. The world looks at us and recoils. This Gaza war will be to us what the 1976 Soweto uprising was to the apartheid system in South Africa, said Uri Bar-Joseph in Haaretz. The pictures of dead children in township streets made that country a leper state, facing boycotts and isolation as the world demanded an end to apartheid. For Israel, it will demand the end of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. It took 28 years after the boycotts began for apartheid to fall. Let's hope Israel's evolution is quicker. In domestic politics, it's time for a great reckoning, said Avi Ashkenazi, also in Mariv. The war lasted so long only because Netanyahu, on trial for offenses related solely to his private personal conduct, prolonged it for his political survival. Now the courts can have at him. Yet Netanyahu has no intention of changing his political path, said Yossi Melman in Walla. Just as he blew numerous chances to bring the hostages home sooner, so is he now squandering this historic moment of regional reconciliation. When Hamas failed to return the bodies of all 28 dead hostages immediately, he reacted by temporarily backtracking on the deal, sharply reducing the humanitarian aid entering Gaza, and then, after Hamas gunmen killed two Israeli soldiers last week, launching airstrikes. But don't think Israelis will turn against him. The release of the hostages has given him a significant political boost, and his Likud party is now more popular than the divided opposition. Strengthened and feeling rejuvenated, Netanyahu sees himself once again as a phoenix rising from the ashes of war, legal battles, public protest, and political crises. He is sure he can win another victory at the ballot box. The last word, our in-depth article, the Pushkin heist. Thieves stole rare editions of Russian classics from libraries across Europe, said Elizabeth Zurovsky in The Economist 1843 magazine. But who are they working for? On an autumn day in 2023, a 49-year-old Georgian man named Mikhail Zamtaradze climbed to the steps of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, the BNF, a complex of four gleaming glass towers at the southeastern edge of Paris. With a buzz cut and the thick build of a security guard, he cut a somewhat anomalous figure at the library. But he was dressed to fit in among the starched shirts and reading glasses, as was his habit. This was his 40th or so visit to the BNF over 6 months. The library's security protocols are strict, but Zamtaradze swanned in with ease. He passed through a metal detector at the vault-like underground entrance, scanned his library ID card at the turnstile, strode through a set of steel doors, rode an escalator even farther underground. Finally, he reached the library's rare books reading room, a small secluded space set apart from the clusters of stacks. Placing his open satchel onto an oak reading table, Zamtaradze asked a librarian if he could see two original first editions by Alexander Pushkin, a 19th century writer widely considered to be Russia's most celebrated poet. He had told the library staff that he was doing research for his dissertation about democracy as a motif in 19th-century Russian literature. After a long wait, the two books were delivered. Glancing incessantly around him, he took his time leafing through the thin ivory pages, careful not to damage the book's fragile bindings. Samtarradze returned to the BNF the following day. He asked to view the same two Pushkins again, but this time in a different room, one that was larger with more nooks and crannies. But his request was denied, and Samtarradze was told the volumes he sought were no longer available. So he packed up and left. It turned out to be his final visit to the BNF, for the following week he was arrested at a Brussels airport on a European warrant. He stood accused of the theft of 17 works by Pushkin and other 19th century Russian writers from the Vilnius University Library in Lithuania. The contents of Samtarradze's suitcases did little to dispel the allegations. He had 17 books in his possession, 11 of which were forgeries of volumes that he had consulted at the BNF over the preceding months. He was also carrying fake ex libris or decorative book plates from the Pushkins that he had asked to see at the BNF a week earlier. And he had more library cards than any academic would need in a lifetime, along with a forged Belgian passport. A month later, in November 2023, French investigators received a call from the BNF's director of collections. Following the Samtarradze's arrest, the library had discovered that 9 of the works he had consulted during his visits had disappeared. Remarkably, the text had been replaced with facsimiles of such high quality, the paper perfectly aged, the covers carefully distressed, a rendering of BNF's stamp in just the right place, that only a rare book specialist with a background in Russian literature might have noticed anything amiss. Between April 2022 and November 2023, as many as 170 first editions of the works of some of Russia's greatest 19th century writers, above all by Pushkin, but also Mikhail Lermontov, Nikolai Gogol, and others, were stolen from national and university libraries across Europe. In addition to the libraries in Paris and Vilnius, institutions in Berlin, Geneva, Helsinki, Lyon, Munich, Prague, Riga, Tallinn, Vienna, and Warsaw were targeted. Most of the books were replaced by fakes, some of astonishingly good quality. In September 2022, whispers began to circulate among the staff of some of Europe's most prominent libraries about a curious theft. At a conference in Vienna, a librarian from the National Library of Latvia in Riga revealed that in April that year, 3 Russian first editions had been stolen by someone pretending to be a Ukrainian war refugee. The man claimed he was interested in studying Russian literature in graduate school. Little else was known until November 2022, when a 46-year-old Georgian man named Veka Terekidze was arrested in Riga. Shown in surveillance footage to be balding, with a rough beard, substantial belly, and piercing blue eyes, Terekidze was convicted as an accomplice in the Latvian theft and sentenced to 6 months in jail. Initially, the crime was thought to be an isolated incident, but a chance DNA match in an inter-European database soon revealed that Terekidze had also been the principal thief behind the disappearance of 8 books from the University of Tartu in southern Estonia. Terekidze appears to have carried out this theft just a day before the one in Latvia, though his ruse was discovered only by chance several months later, when a reader opened several Pushkin and Gogol volumes and found something strange. Stuffed into the original leather or paper bindings were pages from early 19th century books that were in German rather than Russian. It appeared that Terekidze had arranged for the creation of high-quality facsimiles using historical materials. After Terekidze finished his sentence in Latvia, he was extradited to Estonia, where he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. He is still serving his term. Over the next year, European prosecutors began to discover more thefts and share information. At least 10 other members from Terekitsi's organized crime networks, some of whom were his family members, were identified. One was thought to be an expert in book forgery. Another was a pro at making fake ID cards, which the thieves used to register at libraries. The smuggling operations themselves required composure, coordination, and cunning. The thieves exploited the security at the University of Warsaw's library by wearing custom-made jackets with inside pockets so that they could easily take original pages out and bring facsimile pages. Ultimately, they succeeded in stealing 79 volumes, the most from any affected library. The BNF, as a national library, has more stringent measures in place. It requires an application and security clearance to obtain an ID, so even more ingenuity was necessary. According to a legal complaint filed by the BNF, on the days the thieves had designated for page swaps, Zamtarazzi visited the library with what appeared to be a broken arm. Inside the sling, there was a space into which he could slip the stolen pages. Both librarians and law enforcement developed a suspicion that the Georgians were pursuing rare Russian classics, not on their own initiative, but rather at the behest of some shadowy client. Bartosz Jandy, a Polish prosecutor investigating the thefts from the University of Warsaw, told me bluntly, "As far as the group's M.O. is concerned, it's typical organized crime. The only mystery here is who orders those books. And unfortunately, it matches the profile of the methods of the Russian Federation." Pushkin is to Russia what Shakespeare is to England, Goethe is to Germany, Dante is to Italy. A national genius. In his short life, he died at just 37, he wrote scores of poems as well as plays, novels, and fairy tales in verse. With literary triumphs such as the epic love story Eugene Onegin and the political drama Boris Godunov, he established himself as the father of Russian literature. To this day, Russians speak about him with reverence, and many hold strong sentimental attachments to his work dating back to childhood. Today, rich Russian art connoisseurs face a conundrum. They have money to spend, yet limited places to spend it. Sanctions have curtailed their ability to buy things from abroad, and Western dealers and auction houses are cut off from the Russian market. There has since been a surge in interest among domestic buyers in traditional Russian art, religious iconography, paintings of rural life, and other works that stoke national pride or have some historical value. The works of Pushkin in particular serve as status symbols, a demonstration of one's wealth, erudition, and nationalist bona fides. Those investigating the library thefts had reason to believe, however, that a handful of rich collectors weren't the only ones driving the demand for rare Pushkins. Indeed, the cultural significance of the stolen books and the scope of the Georgian gang's smuggling operation initially stirred speculation that the Russian state, which often outsources grubby tasks to organized crime groups, was involved. There is some precedent. Since the annexation of Crimea, a clutch of government groups have allegedly abetted the theft of cultural artifacts from abroad. As the war in Ukraine continues, Russia has been waging a cultural battle in parallel with its territorial one, using Pushkin's image in the occupied territories as a symbol of the eternal greatness of its language and culture. After bombing Mariupol's Grand Theater while civilians were sheltering there, Russian forces draped the destroyed facade with portraits of Russian playwrights and authors, including Pushkin. In Kherson, they have put up billboards plastered with Pushkin's face, declaring that Russia is here forever. Last year, on a bleak winter morning, I went to Warsaw to meet Jandy, the Polish prosecutor who is handling the investigation into the thefts from the University of Warsaw Library. Jandy beckoned me to look over his shoulder at a computer screen, where he pulled up the website for Litfund, a prominent Russian auction house. Scrolling through the offerings, he stopped at photos of a three-volume set of the collected works of Alexander Radishevich, a radical Russian writer from the late 18th century. The books came from the University of Warsaw's collection, Jandy said. They had once featured traceable barcodes, which had been scratched off, as well as the library's blue stamp, which was still faintly visible. You see, they wanted to have a complete item, Jandy observed. The set had sold for 5.5 million rubles, around $50,000, a tidy sum for obscure volumes. Jandy noted that the owner of Litfund, Sergei Burmistrov, had links to the Russian government. He has worked as an expert at the Ministry of Culture, and Burmistrov seems to laud the nationalist value of his work in public. In response to the allegations about the stolen books at Litfund, Burmistrov said, "We do not sell books from state libraries with any stamps that our experts may define as state library stamps." Last summer, in an op-ed for Forbes Russia, he weighed in on the European thefts that are currently on everyone's lips, as he put it. "Pushkin is our everything," he gushed, before denying that Russians or the Russian state were involved in the thefts. "This is not a special operation to export Russian books from Europe," yet he seemed to admonish the libraries for their weak security, a symptom, he implied, of the disregard Europeans had for Russian culture. The thefts of Pushkin's and other rare books have abated, perhaps because so many members of the Sirokidze gang have been arrested. In June, Mikhail Zamtaradze was convicted in Lithuania for stealing the 17 books from the Vilnius University Library. In court, he shared several intriguing tidbits. He claimed that he had been paid $30,000 in cryptocurrency by a man in Russia to seek specific titles, and that the Russian buyer had sent him 12 of the forgeries used in the thefts. Most of the stolen books have still not been recovered. Many probably never will be, as Russian law makes it hard to remove items of cultural value from Russia. By looking at the prices fetched by similar books at Russian auctions, the University of Warsaw Library estimates that the total value of its missing volumes could be nearly $1 million. But as Jandy put it, those books were not for sale. They were part of our cultural heritage, so they didn't have a market value. When I asked other Poles about this notion that their cultural heritage has been stolen, they reacted with ambivalence. The University of Warsaw houses the largest collection of 19th century Russian books outside Russia, an important reminder of a bitter century in Poland's history, when it was subjugated by the Russian Empire. To lose those books, a former university librarian told me, felt like an obfuscation of that history. To be robbed by the country's old imperial overlord also felt like sublimated aggression, particularly since Poland's influence in Europe is growing as it provides military and financial support to Ukraine. Jandy's assistant, a young man named Jacek Sutilarek, said that the fact that those books were stolen back to Mother Russia, it stinks. This was adapted from a larger, longer version of this article that appeared in The Economist's 1843 magazine. Here's one of the health and science shorts. Green turtles are back. The green turtle was once hunted to the brink of extinction for its eggs and meat, considered a delicacy by many upper-class Brits and Americans. Now, after decades of global conservation work, including protecting nests, releasing hatchlings into the sea, and curbing accidental capture in fishing nets, the species has rebounded. At the latest International Union for the Conservation of Nature World Congress, the species status was changed from endangered, where it has been since the 1980s, to least concern. The list of species at threat of extinction is still vast, numbering over 48,000, or some 28% of all species of plants, animals, and fungi assessed. But Brendan Godley, a conservation scientist at the University of Exeter in England, says the recovery of the green turtle, the largest of the seven species of sea turtle, is a cause for optimism. Sea turtles are iconic and charismatic species that inspire people, he tells BBC.com. Hundreds of thousands of people have been working for decades to try to look after these creatures, and undoubtedly, it has had an impact. And we'll have time for one of the Talking Points articles. No King's Rally. What did it achieve? Even for a jaded old political warrior like me, said William Krister in the Bulwark, last weekend's nationwide No Kings protests were deeply moving. In what was likely the largest single protest in the nation's history, some 7 million people assembled peacefully and patriotically in major cities and rural towns like Macon, Georgia, and Plano, Texas, to protest Donald Trump and reaffirm their allegiance to the American idea. The rallies had an inspiring mood of both joy and sobriety and were an emphatic rejection of Trump's assault on the rule of law and the Constitution. Republicans had ludicrously predicted that No Kings would be violent gatherings of Antifa radicals who hate America. But the rally's obvious success triggered Trump. He posted a childish video of a jet emblazoned with King Trump dumping torrents of excrement on the protesters. In interviews, he ominously warned that he could invoke the Insurrection Act in response to large protest, an indication he finds dissent intolerable. Trump has good reason to be threatened by No Kings, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. His growing authoritarian control of the nation depends heavily on the perception that he's the authentic tribune of the people. The images of millions of outraged Americans filling the streets presents a direct rebuke to that narrative, revealing he's far from as popular as he says he is. To diminish the protest, Republicans also tried laughing them off as middle-aged women coded, said Quinita Juerick in The Atlantic. All those wine moms and gray-haired people with punny anti-Trump signs reminding America of our democratic ideals, the right claimed, were earnest, uncool, cringe, in contrast to the cynical, macho, MAGA ethos. But as idealistic as it was, the massive show of defiance struck an important blow against fatalism and could help rally disheartened voters to organize to defeat Trump and his allies. No Kings was a good start, said Ronald Brownstein in Bloomberg. But to convey the urgency of the moment, the loyal opposition needs an edgier tool, a general strike. Millions of workers across multiple sectors of the economy could withdraw their labor for days. General strikes can create attention, urgency, and solidarity, and were effectively used to defeat autocracy in Poland and Brazil. Discussion of this strategy among Trump's opponents is intensifying as a supplement, not a substitute, to mass public protest. And a few of the short notes. Immigration and Customs Enforcement spent more than $71 million on weaponry in the first 10 months of the year, a 700% increase over 2024 levels. Most of the spending was on firearms and armor, but there were also significant purchases of chemical weapons and guided missile warheads and explosive components. The Coast Guard plans to buy two Gulfstream jets for use by Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and other top officials at a total cost of $200 million. The G700 jets have the most spacious cabin in the industry and are the pinnacle of business aviation excellence, according to Gulfstream. The number of industrial robots deployed in Chinese factories increased more than tenfold, from 2014 to 2024 to 2 million. China last year added 297,000 robots, while the U.S. added 34,000. The Trump administration is diverting millions of dollars in terrorism prevention funding away from Democratic-led states, FEMA released estimates in late summer for how much each state should expect to receive through the Homeland Security Grants Program. It subsequently changed the totals, cutting Washington, D.C.'s funding by 70%, Illinois by 69%, and New Jersey's by 49%. States receiving the biggest increase, including Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Ohio, all of which Trump won in 2024. On the poll watch, 27% of Americans believe a war is underway in U.S. cities, while 51% prefer the term a conflict. 29% say there's neither a war nor a conflict. And we'll finish with a couple of cheeky quotes. Mark Twain says, "Few things are harder to put up with than the annoyance of a good example." And actress Diane Keaton, who died recently, says, "Most of us over 60 have come to the point where we recognize that our accomplishments are diddly squat in the grand scheme of things." Take that as you may, but with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.